Newsweek.com.
Easy News.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. It's that time of year, and the U-Hauls have arrived and unloaded the college kids. We asked some students around Boston, what is college all about these days?
Having enough money to pay for it all. Having to buy $500 worth of books and $33,000 worth of tuition. I don't think it's worth $33,000 at all. It seems like natural progression, something you have to do.
Well, it's just dealing with all the stupid chicks. They're all just like these crappy people who just like sit around in their Gucci crap and pretend like they're the hot shit, but they're not. I guess I didn't know.
The hardest thing was coming into a dorm with someone that you didn't know at all, and it was the most lonely feeling ever. Like, just sitting there on your computer, I felt like the biggest computer nerd. Doo-doo-doo, typing away, you know?
You have to have a roommate again. Most people haven't had roommates since they lived with their siblings when they were really little. One person gets sick, everybody gets sick.
I think the hardest thing is figuring out either how to cook for yourself or how to pace yourself in the cafeteria. Because once the food is all there and it's all free and it's all made, it's just easy to keep going back for more and more and more and more.
Our guest, the novelist Tom Perata, has gone back to relive his college days. He nailed the quintessential American high school experience in his last novel, which became the hit movie Election. It jogged everybody's memory of the obnoxious, overbearing class president. Memories of the clueless, dumb jock captain of the football team, the teacher everyone loved, and the power of janitors. Tom Perata has graduated from high school now. The setting of his new novel, called Joe College, is the early 80s at Yale, against the soundtrack of Bruce Springsteen and Steely Dan. The campus characters in this novel are the towny kid who thinks he's at Yale because of a mistake in the admissions office. There's the pretty theater major who's having an affair with the young, hip English professor. There's the preppy rich kid who hates his parents, and the argumentative Marxist who wears a cape. This may have been Tom Perata's experience, but it may have been yours too. Connection listeners, picture your college roommates this hour. Who were you in college? Are you amazed that you made it through without a laptop and a cell phone? What would you pay to go back? But what would you want to be paid to go back? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the college connection all over again. Tom Perata, welcome back. I don't know if this was your experience at Yale. It sounds a lot like mine, but maybe it's everybody's. Was it George W.'s?
It was most definitely not George W.'s. First, in fact, I think Danny, the protagonist of Joe College, who gets there in about 1979, would not have been admitted in George W.'s days, and if he had, he wouldn't have been able to afford it. And I think
George W. would not have known him, but Danny would have known George W.
Yeah, Danny knew a few people like George W. And, you know, doesn't necessarily dislike them. They're from another tribe, and this is part of his experience. He's come from a kind of small, working-class, close-knit community, and he's in this sort of pageant of America that's Yale, you know, and that includes preppies like George W. who've had it easy, but maybe think of themselves as outsiders because they're from somewhere else. But I think the important thing is that Danny's in the process of making this place his own.
I'm interested in your book, in my own memory, in the memories of Connection listeners, in this general question about what was hard about college, what made it hard, and is the difficulty of it entirely different? I mean, your character is struggling through Middlemarch in this book, and that is sort of the core challenge. I'm not sure that's not the struggle that kids talk to us about on the street the last few days. I mean, it's not, these kids are worried about stupid chicks or having a roommate or...
Yeah, one he's worried about, he wouldn't call them stupid chicks because what he likes are the smart chicks. But he's worried about girls, and he's worried about books. I mean, this is the hard thing about college, and people alluded to it when they talked about the loneliness in the dorm, or, you know, trying to discipline yourself in the dining hall. You're suddenly free. You're free, and you're being transformed, and for some period, you don't know who you are, and so you can be anyone. And for some people, that's liberating and wonderful, and for other people, that is a time of, you know, crushing anxiety.
I was at Yale well before you, but I wonder, were any of us free in those days the way kids are free today?
Free to be who you can be within that context, free to be outside the preconceptions that people you grew up with have about you, free to, in my case, you know, be an intellectual, which is something that I, you know, was toying with in those days, but couldn't have lived at all in high school. That was a closet thing for me. So it's a place where you come out, you know, people come out in various ways. But I came out as a guy who could read Middlemarch.
That's interesting. You know, what does it tell you that in the campaign 2000, we're dealing in the front runners here with two, in a certain way, fixated college kids? Not entirely, but I mean, George W. gets a lot of punishment for being the eternal frat boy. Al Gore gets a certain amount of ridicule, too, for imagining that he was the subject of Eric Segal's novel Love Story. He was the Ryan O'Neill hockey-playing character in love with Ally McGraw. What does it tell you that we're all still in college?
We're all still in college, and I think the missing factor here is Bill Clinton, who is the boy of the meritocracy. He's very different from somebody like George W. And somebody like Al Gore, who are American aristocrats. As much as they try and say, you know, Al Gore says his mom was a waitress, George W. says, I'm from Texas, I'm an oilman. Bill Clinton really is somebody who lived among, you know, real Americans at some point and can talk to them. And I think, in a way, he seems much more human to people for that. And it's why he was forgiven, I think, in a way that some other people might not be forgiven.
You remind me that your movie Election and the book had certain correspondences with Reagan's and Clinton's and real-life big candidates. Who are the presidential models of your characters in Joe College? or the public model, shall we say?
Well,
I mean, some of it comes from your memory, some of it comes from the headlines, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was thinking of this character, Danny, and thinking about somebody like Bill Clinton. You know, I think some people look at Bill Clinton and Paula Jones and say, what is the president of the United States doing with this woman who's a low-level secretary in Arkansas who wears tight dresses? And, you know, one of the things I noticed about Danny is that you know, he's leaving behind this working-class world he's from, but he's got this girlfriend from back there who is a secretary and in some ways not on the same level as him. But his desires were formed in a world where a girl like Cindy was utterly fetching to him, and he's working that out here. You know, and when I hear about Bill Clinton and Paula Jones, I don't necessarily see, like, something exploitive. I imagine that some part of him is still in high school in Hope, Arkansas, and thinks she's, you know, I think she's a hot girl.
In Hot Springs, in fact.
Hot Springs. Very hot.
What is the rite of passage here? You write in your own case, I mean, in the Tom Perotta case, Yale was a place for you to come out as an intellectual, to begin testing the idea of yourself as a reader, writer, thinker. What is it for the rest of us, do you think?
Well, you know, I think college is two things in this sense. It's a place where people get transformed in various ways. It's also a place where people get homogenized into a kind of, you know, the people that we might be, and maybe a lot of listeners are. We are the NPR listening, New York Times reading, you know, internet savvy elite, you know. And so for Danny, that's a very clear journey from, you know, working class world where he's part of a community to a kind of cosmopolitan elite. You know, he's joining the elite in various ways, and he's going to have a lot more in common with somebody who grew up in unthinkable circumstances to him. You know, his friend Max, whose parents have a house in Aspen, and, you know, are donors who get their pictures taken with Ronald Reagan. He suddenly has more in common with Max than he does with somebody he grew up with, and it's happening right there under his feet. And I think if he, you know, the genesis of the book for me was my own feeling as I approached Yale, I'm not going to let this change me. You know, I am who I am, and you know, my people are the people that I grew up with, and I'm going to come here and I'm going to take what I can from this place, but it's not going to change me. And of course, that seems ridiculous from, you know, any distance. But the important thing in this book, I think, was to try and get back into that mindset and show him at this last moment when he belonged both to this working class world and to this this elite world. And then suddenly he's got dual citizenship. He's uncomfortable in both. But he is walking this tight wire and trying to have an identity that serves in both places.
I thought the same thing. I went to Yale thinking this isn't going to be important. I'm always going to remember high school. That's what formed me. And then I'll never forget a guy, an older white Jewish cab driver, took me from the New Haven Railroad Station to the old campus. And as I got out there with my two suitcases, he said, you know, I notice in the world when they're looking for a really... to fill an important job, they usually go for the Yale man. And I thought, wow, this could be interesting. I put it to Connection listeners. Was college for you the experience of sort of joining the club of your real life, of finding another identity? And what was hard about it? Was it the money? Was it the loneliness? Was it the girls? Was it the crowd? Was it the cooking? Was it the food? Or was it the books? Did you read the books? In what sense, then, now, always, and ever, is college the great rite of passage? And is it different? My own experience as a parent is that it's college nowadays is almost entirely a social passage. And my kids were readers and writers in a way before they got to college. But the intellectual experience dimmed before everything else. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK, the college connection with the novelist Tom Barada, whose new book is called Joe College.
And what you were saying just before about the intellectual part of college, you know, I asked myself as I was writing this, you know, because I've been teaching in the past 10 years, is college disappearing? And what I meant by that is the ideology of college that I grew up with disappearing? I think there are a lot fewer people who come to college thinking this is a zone of exploration or social criticism, a place to read great books and kind of contemplate the world, live the examined life. You know, we came to college, or I came to college, in a kind of the last moment of the great books. You know, the time when you thought there was a coherent canon and all you had to do was master it and you would become an educated person. You know, that's gone now and possibly for good reasons. But it makes college, I think, more it's a less literary, less humanistic place. Kids are coming there not to criticize American society, but to join it real fast because it's a pretty go-go place right now. And you can make a lot of money. And, you know, there were always people doing that. But I think just proportionally, the liberal arts are, you know, in serious decline, and maybe there are people who would disagree.
You say this as a college teacher now.
Yeah, yeah, I do. And I remember that, you know, if a teacher mentioned a book, you know, I'm talking about Yale, I'm talking about a certain stratum of, you know, American education, but if somebody mentioned a book, you know, I sort of felt like I better read that book. And I just don't feel like there's that sense in the world. And now it seems like books are optional. Reading, people just don't have enough time to read. And they don't know what to read because there's not some prescribed list anymore. And, you know, that might be fine, but I think, you know, choice has its downside as well.
1-800-423-8255 makes the college connection. Connection, this is how would you do it differently? Would you do it again at all? Would you wait 5 years before you entered college in the first place? 1-800-423-8255. Anne is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Anne.
Hi. Thank you. My experience was very different because I lived at home and I went to a small state school. And so I wished I had lived at school, but I couldn't at the time. But the biggest challenge for me was just the intellectual challenge, going from high school to college and wondering if I could read those books and contribute to the discussion. And it really took a whole year before I felt that I could even contribute intellectually to what was happening in the classroom.
And so was that the rite of passage that you went through, Anne?
Yeah, because at the end of my 4 years, I really felt, wow, I could do this. I you know, the capability was there. I was able to really contribute to discussions. I got so much better at writing papers. And it was very scary at first. And never mind a huge, you know, wonderful school, but just a tiny, you know, Rhode Island college was a really great leap for me.
And did you leave home after that?
I lived on my own after college, but not during. That was one thing I really missed, because I did miss the connection there with the other students. It was more the commuter school.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you did it in that order, because I think one of the things that's stressful about college is that people are usually juggling all these things at once. They're trying to get their intellectual grounding, and they're trying to live among strangers. And sometimes the anxiety that comes with those two things together can be, doubly difficult.
But I think that's interesting that for Anne, the test was, can I hack the books? Can I make it intellectually? 1-800-423-8255, the college connection. Christina is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Christina.
Hi, I just wanted to share my experience in college. I was in a sorority, which I think is a very different experience and one that's often stereotyped, and just wanted to share the experience that I had.
Where was this? You don't sound old enough for college.
I know. I'm actually 34, but I have a kid's voice. I went to UMass Amherst, which is a large school, as you know, and I, for some reason, joined a sorority. I don't know why. I was young. I just kind of decided to do it.
What was it?
Chi Omega.
Mm-hmm.
And lived with 50 women, and we, you know, we all supported and loved one another and knew that we could count on each other for support, be it with boyfriends or out late drinking and lost and need somebody to come pick you up, or, you know, support in education, which is obviously the reason we were supposed to be there.
Is Chi Omega still there?
It is. It is, and I actually hosted a reunion this summer on the Cape, and 25 people came.
Wow.
And we just relived our college years. Obviously, a lot of us have kids and are married now, so it was a little different.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I'm sort of fascinated by this, because I started this book with the idea that I was going to write about a state school and fraternities, because I'd met a lot of people who it surprised me later in life. They'd say, oh, yeah, I was in a frat, you know, and they'd tell wild frat stories to me. And I was surprised at that, because I had stereotyped ideas about who was in frats and what happened there. But I realized the more I thought about my own college, just how anomalous it was and how much I wanted to explore that. But I think one of the things we do have in common is this fact about college, which is, unlike any other time in your life, you have this vast amount of social information coming at you. You know the intimate details of the lives of dozens or possibly even hundreds of people. And that's part of the education of it. You know details you don't even want to know about people you wish you hadn't met, but it's all there and it's coming at you.
But you mean to say you're sort of fixing your own place in a much bigger social sample than you've ever met before?
Absolutely. And, your life unfolds in public. At least if you live in a sorority there, she said she lived with 50 women. I would often live in, groups of three or four, but in entryways with, 10 rooms like that. And your life was an open book. If you had a date, people you didn't even know would ask you how it went.
Right. And if you went away for the weekend, you'd come back and find one of your dear roommates sleeping with somebody else probably in your bed.
That's possible.
1-800-423-8255. Makes the college connection with the novelist Tom Perata. Mark is on the line.
Hi, Chris. It's Mark Roberts.
Hey, Mark. Welcome.
And I was really...
Professor Mark Roberts.
Yeah, I was...
Harvard
I was,
veteran Mark Roberts.
Right. Oh, happy to talk to two Yale guys. I was struck. My son went to Harvard in the 90s, and I went to Harvard in the 60s. And one of the things I was really struck about, the difference between yours and Tom's comments, my life was much more like Tom's. I came from, Bayonne, New Jersey, tough industrial town, didn't know anybody, got to Harvard and found one of my freshman roommates was the son of the president of Swarthmore College. And the third week we were there, he invited me to the opening of the Met Opera with his cousin, and I wore a tuxedo for the first time. I mean, it was it was an incredible sense of this transformation, this moving into a different world. Hmm. And my son's experience at Harvard in the 90s, I think, was really quite different in that, in an important way, he grew up in the NPR listening, New York Times reading world. But for him, the intellectual part of it was very much at the center of his life. I mean, you said, Chris, it wasn't at the center of your kids' life in a way. For him,
not the way it was mine, that's for sure.
Well, for him, the books were still there, the taking courses with great people like Jack Rawls was there, and I really thought he got a very good education, and that at least in his circle, kids worked pretty hard. I mean, they may not have had the classical canon to read, but they seem to spend a lot of time reading.
I didn't mean to say that my kids just partied all the time either, but I think they came to terms with social experience in a way that we didn't in the 50s and 60s. And it was very valuable. They had also done a lot of reading before they got to college that I hadn't done even when I got out of college.
It's
funny. It seems to me nowadays at Harvard, maybe Yale too, every other person, every other kid is the son of somebody very famous. In my day, it was exceptional. I had the experience, though, just before going off to freshman year, I picked up Sports Illustrated, and there was a fashion article about a guy I immediately recognized as my roommate. He was the president of his class at Beverly Hills High School, handsome as God, and, Fred Astaire's daughter was his classmate. I mean, he was a national celebrity before he even arrived on campus. It was daunting. And then he flunked out at, freshman year with a 52 average, and I felt bad.
And you got your revenge.
Well, he was a nice guy. I didn't want revenge on him.
Yeah, well, I think Mark's experience was a lot like mine, and I think there's something very powerful about this experience. Social advancement is kind of regulated in the society in the way that it didn't used to be. And you go to an Ivy League school like this, and you go from feeling like a lot of Americans do, that there's some cabal that's running the world, mm-hmm. and suddenly you're meeting them and you're meeting their children. And I guess you can respond to that in a couple ways. And one of those ways is to think, I can do this too. This isn't...
Yeah. I've often thought that you could define the cabal that was running the world by all the people who could call someone who in turn could call the president. Instead of 6 degrees of
separation. 2 degrees of separation, right.
Who's one step away from the president? And then I thought of my experience at Harvard, and to this day, anyone I know, either Republican or Democrat, who could call the president, I met as an undergraduate. You're quite right, Chris. I think the Ivy League institutions, if an anthropologist landed from Mars or Alpha Centauri and was trying to ask what is the function of this institution in the society, it is a place heavily where people are recruited into and certified in their membership in the elite, and they meet and connect with other people who are part of that elite.
At Yale, it was easier because there was the famous Yale word shoe, meaning white shoe. And if you were shoe, you were 2 degrees away from the president. You thought, anyway. You're listening to The Connection. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, The College Connection. Would you do it again, Connection listeners? And what would you want to be paid? Mike is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Welcome, Mike.
I'm director of student activities at a small New England college, and I work with students every day. And I think the biggest thing I've seen change is not only do they expect the books, the education, the 3 square meals a day, but they also expect their entire life to be programmed for them, to have activities and entertainment 24 hours a day.
Hmm. And how do you supply it?
Long hours, but if they don't have it, they're calling the president of the institution. Their parents are calling. I think it's a quicker button to say, Mom, Dad, these people aren't supplying what I need.
What do they mean by entertainment? In my day, and I think at the big schools nowadays, there's a very kind of intimidating long list of lectures that you could be going to. People speaking, UN ambassadors or sort of novelists on the rampage. That was what we thought was sort of the show, as well as old movies and that kind of thing. What do kids mean today by entertainment?
We'll put an author on the stage, and we won't get anyone there. But we'll put, someone from MTV's Real World on the stage, and there's 300 students there.
Mm-hmm.
It's fast food for them.
Right. Well, and this is related, I think, to another problem. I think that kids want their lives to be planned out. Nobody wants to miss out on joining the middle class. And I meet kids at Harvard who have been preparing to go to Harvard since they were 7 years old. They've been going to summer camps. They've been having, taking the SATs several times. And I think what happens is it's become a kind of a job and a kind of grind. And maybe to some degree what's being lost is this feeling of exploration and of intellectual growth. You know, people really feel like they're on some high-powered conveyor belt. And they also feel like they're consumers who are paying a lot for an experience and they want to reap the rewards in concrete terms rather than in sort of more personal terms that are harder to define.
Mike, what are your kids paying?
$25,000 a year for a room, board, and education.
Books not included?
And one of my students just paid over $600 for them.
So they're not optional either?
Nope.
No wonder they want to play pool.
How does it change them, Mike?
Well, from freshman to senior, they go through a tremendous amount of change, but when they come in, it's me, me, me. I need, need, need. And I don't think it changes that much until they're seniors. But there, it's what are you doing for me to get me the job?
It's about the job in the end, a way to wealth.
Well, they get involved to get their resume. They don't get involved, I don't think, as much for personal growth anymore.
Well, I think the whole society is turning into a society of free agents who are sort of demanding something from people that they used to feel like they were in a kind of subordinate relationship to. So you get, in a tight labor market, people going to employers and saying, you know, making demands and getting them. You get people going to college and making demands.
We're reliving college. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the College Connection, 1-800-423-8255. We're remembering roommates. We're remembering pretensions. We're remembering big books that we did and sometimes didn't read with Tom Perata, whose new novel is called Joe College. It's about a working-class kid from New Jersey at Yale in the early 80s, but it could be Joe College almost any time in the last 50 years, and it may well be you. 1-800-423-TALK makes the College Connection. Read a little bit about young Danny's pretensions and ambitions at Yale in the 80s, Tom.
Yeah, Danny is, as I say, is a kid from working-class New Jersey, but he also is starting to think of himself perhaps as a writer. So there's some kind of autobiographical aura here, and I just want to talk a little bit about his literary career at Yale. He's a second semester junior, and he's reflecting on the year gone by. That fall turned out to be a breakthrough semester for me, the first time I ever really felt at home in college. As thrilled as I'd been by the intellectual challenges, my freshman and sophomore years had been emotionally and socially difficult. I felt trapped and resentful a lot of times, marooned within a small circle of friends and acquaintances, cut off from the wider life of the college, which seemed to be dominated by overlapping prep school cliques I wouldn't have known how to penetrate if I'd wanted to. Junior year, though, the whole place just cracked wide open. Two changes were responsible for my new sense of excitement and belonging. I got hooked up with Reality and went to work in the dining hall. Reality was a new undergraduate literary magazine founded by Liz Marin, whom I'd met the previous spring in a class on the epic tradition. Liz was the kind of person I'd never met before coming to Yale. She'd grown up in New York and Paris and had taken a year off after high school to go backpacking through Latin America. She was tall and beautiful and multilingual and fiercely opinionated. One of her opinions held that the rags that passed for literary magazines on campus were so smug and tame and insular that it was hopeless to even try to reform them. They simply needed to be replaced. Her idea was to create a magazine devoted to everything but college, one that focused on exploited workers, violent crime, urban poverty, and moral squalor. The whole wide, hardscrabble world spread out like a dirty rug at the foot of our ivory tower. In a word, reality.
Go, Liz!
No more sonnets about menstruation.
I hope
menstruation.
Liz is listening.
No more sonnets about menstruation, she proclaimed at her organizational meeting with what seemed like genuine anguish. No more wacky stories about summer jobs. Our first issue, published that December. The cover featured a stray dog with some sort of skin condition, straining really hard to take a shit, made a surprisingly big splash on campus. The articles included profiles of a prison guard and a heroin-addicted prostitute, and the poems explored difficult subjects like incest and drug addiction and prison life. There were two short stories, one about a pyromaniac priest, the other about a 13-year-old nymphomaniac who poisons her family's dogs for reasons the author chose to leave deliberately vague. Liz herself was a talented photographer, and her unflinching portraits of the homeless, the retarded, the weird-looking, and the unlucky were scattered throughout our pages. Despite the grittiness of the content, production values were high. A supposedly anonymous alum, everyone knew he was actually Liz's Uncle George, had donated a substantial sum to ensure that we didn't have to cut corners on things like paper stock and high-quality photo reproduction. Just about everyone who mattered agreed that reality was troubling and deeply relevant, a refreshing departure from the usual circle jerk of undergraduate publishing. As deputy assistant literary editor for fiction, I got to bask in some of the reflected glory. Strangers introduced themselves to me at parties. People who'd ignored me for 2 years suddenly wanted to get to know me better.
Liz, are you listening? Call in. Give us your side of the story. Answer Tom Perata on The Connection. Defend Reality Magazine, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about college memories, Connection listeners. Do you remember who you were, who you thought you were, who you thought you were becoming, who you were trying to run away from in your college years? 1-800-423-TALK. James is on the line.
Hi there, Chris.
Welcome, James.
I'm 25, and I'm finishing my last semester at MIT now after a long and arduous journey, and I just wanted to comment that I find that college is exactly a protracted adolescence, and I think, I don't know about other universities, but MIT is certainly structured that way.
In a good way, as the kids say, or not?
I think perhaps a necessary way. Good or bad, I'm not sure. I know that, like, I'm not unique in taking quite a long time to leave, and it seems that people don't leave until they're done with school. And in fact, school doesn't let them leave until it's done with them. So I think that there's a certain processing that happens at MIT, at least.
Well, no question that adolescence has been extended in American life. But for you, is it a matter of? What does that mean for you? Is it mean postponing sort of big decisions? Is it a matter of party time or what? I mean, the other side of college, which seems to run the other way, is that, as Tom said, college is no longer a kind of haven retreat from the hurly burly of real life. It's a kind of jet-propelled plunge into a sort of quick window of opportunity into American life.
Well, in a lot of ways, though, you can't grow up while you're in college. You've got free superlative health care in general. You have a dormitory where we were discussing earlier the publicness of life. So I think that while you're in college, you are still an adolescent just by being there.
Hmm. Well, my own sense there is that, you know, why do we want to grow up? America is a youth culture, and, you know, I certainly feel like I was spoiled by college. I remember, you know, walking around on, you know, Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock in the beautiful sunshine, thinking, well, maybe I'll just sit on this green grass here and maybe I'll read this book and maybe I won't. And I had a very clear idea of, you know, what my life would have been if I hadn't been there. You know, I would have been working. I wouldn't have been sitting on the green grass at 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. And in many ways, you know, I've tried to structure my life since then so I can sit on the green grass on Thursday afternoon and maybe read a book. College always seemed to me kind of an idyllic and ideal life. And, To give it up for the working world, you know, always seemed like a kind of a sad option.
James, what are you going to do for an encore?
What am I going to do for an encore? I hope to move to New Mexico and
grow up.
Sculptor. I'm done with MIT and I want to leave.
That sounds like a very adult plan, James.
Maybe.
James, good luck, and thank you for calling 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
I'm an African-American that went to Boston College during the same period, I think, that your book, Tom, was set up, actually from 78 to 81, mm-hmm. at a tumultuous time in Boston politics and ethnic and racial relationships. And I'd say that I didn't have the luxury of remaining an adolescent. Fortunately, my family, I came from a working-class family with middle-class ideals, and they had exposed me to some of the social and academic requirements that were going to be in front of me. But I spent a whole lot of time with my majority counterparts explaining to them and letting them see my culture and showing them the realities of the culture. And disproving a lot of the myths that came along with it. And a lot of us, and I'm not only talking about African-Americans, but people of color in general from other cultures, we would get around and say, can you believe some of the things that these young people are taught at home? And they're not malicious or racially prejudiced things, but just inaccuracies. For example, the myth that they thought that when they heard that I have a mother and father and that both my parents, who were very involved with my education, when they would come up and visit me, they'd say, gee, some of the black people I know, I never see their father. And those kinds of things. And a lot of times, like, once again, they were innocent because maybe that's just where they came from, or the only black folks that were around were janitorial or whatever. But we spent an awful lot of time sitting with them, and the ones that were very, very open, saying, gee, I can't believe I've lived my life this far and thought this and that. Well, then we enjoyed it, but then there were a large group of people that we just didn't have the time to put into it. So my experience has been more, and it's interesting to talk about this because it's actually the first time I've revisited it in years, and I appreciate this program for it.
Well, thanks, Mike. You know, it's you use the word innocent, and I think that's one thing that I thought about in writing this book. You know, I have some characters in here who are Korean-American and Japanese-American. I thought a lot about the way that I connected with Asian-American students, and they refer to one African-American student in the dorm and how he's never around. He's kind of living a separate life from them. I think it was an innocent time because there was some sense that diversity would just work on its own, that if people just lived together, they would get to know each other and a lot of social tensions would disappear. And I think experiences like yours prove that it wasn't going to be that easy. And I think what happened later was a more separated world and a lot more skepticism about diversity.
Mike, do you feel you were much more grown up, essentially, and experienced than the white kids you went to school with?
Oh, I absolutely did. At that time, I was 17, but I still felt it was a mixed feeling. I kind of liked the fact that I had more experiences around different cultures. But in a way, I could appreciate their innocence. And I would sit on the back of the bus, or in the bus and say, my goodness, I wish all I had to worry about was which monogram sweater I'm going to wear and where I'm going to go on Friday night for a kegger. Hmm. I really wish I had that opportunity, but I didn't. So it was a mixed feeling. I must say, though, that the time that we're talking about, the late 70s and early 80s, particularly in Boston, Boston had to go through those times. And because of it now, I just went back to my university this morning. And because of it, you can tell that the local kids that grew up in Boston, white, black, or otherwise, have a much more well-rounded attitude towards other cultures. Boston had to go through that time period to see if it paid off.
Mike, thank you. It's interesting. We went through something in that period, and we're probably better for it. 1-800-423-8255 makes the college connection. Wes is on the line.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Wes.
Hi, Wes.
Hey, just calling up, actually, to provide some support for your guest's excellent comments about the importance of humanities education. And I've got an interesting story to demonstrate why I agree with that statement. And I'm kind of on the surface of a stereotypical science grunt. I studied chemistry and biochemistry in college at Duke. Went to medical school, an MD-PhD program, actually, at Harvard MIT, which is where I am right now. And like your previous caller, I didn't grow up too wealthy, and so as a student in college, I was worried about debt, and so I was looking for extra money, and I thought about going on a game show. In my case, it was Jeopardy. And so because Jeopardy tended to have material more from the humanities, partly for that reason, I found a practical justification to read up on the classics, for example. I became a real history.
There's a reason to read the classics. You could be on Jeopardy.
The American
exactly.
Dream.
And it started out that way, and I actually did wind up getting on in 1997.
Did you win, Wes?
I'm sorry?
What did you win?
I did pretty well. It was about $60,000.
Ooh.
On there five times. So,
support public radio. Go
you
ahead.
Get your tuition back.
Exactly. It does help to pay for medical school. But in any case, one miraculous thing that happened to me, it's one of these epiphanies, I guess, is that I really found out how much I love these, I love those subject areas. And I think partly because chemistry is such an all-consuming major, it was difficult for me to fit the courses into my college education. And it was upsetting that I was missing out on that part of my growth, I think. And when I started to read, whether it was Pliny or some of the the French classic French authors or the English authors or anyone, even I've got into some of the less well-known authors in the classical sense, such as Chinua Achebe, for example, Blaise Inca. I found out how enriching that was to me, and I think that a lot of situations that I run into these days, I'm much better off dealing with because of that aspect of my education. And I would certainly be worried if in the future students became so practically oriented, whether it be any kind of a science technical field or kind of a business field, that they neglected that because it helps you in practical ways.
Mike, Wes, you should dangle Jeopardy in front of all of them.
That's a good
idea. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Peter's on the line. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. I enjoy the show, Chris.
Thank you.
I listen to it often. Interesting subject. I'm probably going to run right out and buy your book.
No, thanks.
Tom. Yeah.
Cheap at twice the price. Go ahead.
The beauty of Amazon. I wanted to tell a little bit of my story and make a comment about the impact I think it has on a college student as to whether their parents are paying or whether they're worrying about the money. And I think it has a huge impact intellectually on the process that takes place and the quality of the education. I got kicked out of Northwestern after freshman year, failed out because I was a big party hound, got into the frat scene and everything. And then while you were at Yale in the early 80s, I was working as a messenger and a mailroom clerk for $5 an hour at Tyler Cooper and Alcorn Law Firm in New Haven.
Wow.
And singing in the Yale Russian chorus, actually. And after 2.5 years, went back to school as a self-finance student. They let me back in. I went back, and I'd filed tax returns 2 years in a row, so they gave me aid based on my own resources, et cetera, et cetera. So I managed to get through and finish it, but the real impact was that there was no intellectual life in that second time around because I worked several jobs. And I think that for students that aren't part of that parentally financed post-adolescent kind of wave, and there are some of them. There's a pocket of them at every school, the ones that are there on scholarship and working jobs and stuff. It has a tremendous intellectually deadening impact because I really couldn't afford to worry about the learning. I was just worried about getting through and kind of getting my ticket punched. And it's only
you think it's intellectually deadening to be working two jobs. You think it's better for your brain to let Dad do it?
Well, I think that, if I had it to do over again, I would do it in a minute, and you wouldn't have to pay me anything if I could come out zero, even at the end, or even in debt, but not,
Are you saying pay your way or not?
I'm saying not. I'm saying I think that we should have a system much as Europe does, where it doesn't cost you $25,000 a year to go to
either,
small
either, either that or win some big money on Jeopardy. You're listening to The Connection, 1-800-423-8255. Makes The Connection, 1-800-423-TALK. Ken is on the line.
Hello, Chris.
Welcome, Ken.
Picking up on that last caller's point, I just put a daughter through Bryn Mawr and a son through Skidmore.
Congratulations.
At those $30,000 a year numbers.
Prolong that adolescence, man.
Correct. I had a middle-class upbringing and went through Northeastern and got an MBA at Babson that I worked for, and companies helped me pay for. And my wife was a Bridgewater and then a Boston College teacher. And we've come to the conclusion that we'd like to go back now at 50-some, but we don't want to go back where the kids are. We want a college for people our age with all the trappings of a Bryn Mawr or a Skidmore.
It's called the connection, man. You're listening to it.
Yeah, and get more of the connection dose on a regular basis with somebody else paying the bill for it.
With real teachers and real girls around you, right?
The teachers can even be younger, but the students have to be 50.
Well, this goes along with my sense that for whole generations of Americans now, college is the sort of idyllic, the one idyllic experience you get to have. You know, high school's kind of a difficult place for most people, and the work world is, you know, pretty relentless. And I think that one sort of idyllic space you get is college. And I think that, you know, to structure a retirement around something like a college makes a lot of sense. And people are actually thinking about it. And I've thought about that as well. Yeah. Yeah. There are like these learning centers often in university towns now. Retired professors are, you know, gathering in certain retirement communities and kind of keeping the academy as a kind of a lifelong thing rather than something just for kids who may not appreciate it.
Is that what you're thinking about, Ken?
Yes, or even more of a, I like the diversity of being around young people. I think it keeps us young, but I wouldn't want to be the only 50-year-old in a class of 20-somethings. I'd like to be in a class of other 50-year-olds with serious purpose, taking the classics and the things we missed when we took training institutions like Northeastern or business courses or to be a teacher. I'd like to put more intellectual activity into it this time, but with peers, not young people.
Yeah, well, you know,
it's a great idea.
I taught for a while at the Harvard Extension School, and I found that, you know, people were all ages post-college, and they're, you know, very, very serious students because they were people who saw intellectual life as an alternative to work and not just as some, you know, necessary next step in their progress toward adulthood.
Ken, thank you. It's a serious idea and a good one. 1-800-423-8255 makes the college connection. Ellen is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Ellen.
Hi. All of your comments have been from men so far, and I thought I would add my 2 cents from a female perspective.
Please.
I too attended college in the late 70s, early 80s, but I attended an all-female college. And I think that today, that as you mentioned earlier about the how colleges become more of a social event, that today single-sex education is probably an irrelevant institution.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely not, and I have a daughter now, and I will not encourage her to go to any single-sex institution. And I know there's been research about the fact that women that go to single-sex education schools go on to achieve more, but I find that hard to believe because I look around me and I look at so many women who went to co-ed schools that maybe were single-sex at one point that were open to men and women, and they've really achieved. They've achieved quite a bit, and no more than I have or any of my classmates.
What do you feel that you missed out on?
On just being friends with men, and you sort of go crazy afterward because you just don't know how to be friends with men because they're always something that they're sort of forbidden fruit, and you never see them. You hardly ever see them. The only time you see them is when they're being trucked in or you're being trucked out. And
do you work with men, Ellen? Do you compete with men in your job?
Yeah, and I certainly don't think of myself as being a woman when I work with them or even go after business like them. I guess maybe that's one advantage. But I don't think anybody really does unless they're really hyper-conscious of it and they're feminists. And I personally don't think of it, but there are some women that are very conscious of it and conscious of male competition, but I personally am not, and I know some of my friends are not.
Well, that's the great divide between my Yale time and Tom's, was that it was an all-guy thing in my experience, and quite the opposite in yours. I envy you that without any qualification.
Yeah, well, it was a very interesting thing because it still felt like an experiment there. And, you know, people's parents would be shocked to find out the kind of close quarters that we lived in. On the other hand, we all had this ideology that we were going to be friends, that it wasn't going to be sexual. And, of course, you always ended up with a girl from across the hall.
Tom Parada, thank you enormously. Tom Parada's new book is called Joe College. We had help today from Nahani Rouse, Glenn Alexander, and Kim Bichari. You can continue the college conversation on our website at theconnection.com. oneword.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
We were merely freshmen. We were only freshmen.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3 of Concord, creators of contemporary handcrafted jewelry and precious metals and rare gems, featuring ideal cut.